The African philosophy is something that's kind of missing, I think, a lot from the discourse.
What I wanted to kind of highlight is just like the importance of us going back to Africa.
Just because you're a hypocrite
doesn't mean you're wrong.
It doesn't mean you're wrong. Doesn't remove the validity of the question.
I think it's the issue of picking on Africa.
We need to create a generation where there's so many young, bright leaders.
Welcome to Afrolog Podcast, a platform for informed debate and discussion on African and the wider Black community issues.
Hi, welcome to Afrolog Podcast. My name is Rashid, and today we have with us Dami.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dami. I'm a regular member of the Afrolog team.
Bethena.
Hi, my name is Bethena. I'm regularly also on the Afrolog Pod team.
Ara London. And we've got Dami O. Cool. Today we're going to be discussing Africa's role in Black Lives Matter. And I'm going to start off the question, I'm going to dive right into it with, does Africa actually have any role to play in the Black Lives Matter movement?
Can I go? Okay.
Are you going first?
Oh, sorry. Please, ladies first.
No, go.
Okay, thank you. I think protest movements have to feed into each other. So someone on Twitter a few weeks ago made the observation about the civil rights movement in America happening at the same time as the independence from colonialism movement in Africa. And it may not be a pure coincidence that those two things were happening at the same time. So I think it's important that that there's diaspora movements and that there are African movements on the continent and that they feed into each other. And actually, I think that's what we're seeing happening now with the different protest movements going on in Africa, which I'm sure we're going to go into, combining with the kind of Western Black Lives Matter movements as well.
But then I have something different to say.
No, I'm kind of going to add on to what he said. I feel like for the longest time we were looking at events such as the Arab Spring, and we were just like, when are we going to have our own kind of, not spring or awakening, but our own kind of, like, there's so much discontent, so much resentment for our leaders bubbling up. When was that going to get to the surface and hit the streets? So I feel like, and I think I mentioned this when we were talking about, what country were we talking about? We're talking about a country, and the army and the police have been called to settle down citizens. And so whatever happens in America, best believe that it is tenfold in Africa. Like, when you're traveling around, okay, I can only speak for Tanzania, but when you're traveling around Tanzania, you just, even though you're innocent, you just don't want to start the police off or give them any reason or any excuse to start on you. So I just felt like all of this is bubbling up and it needs to hit the motherland as well. There's so much there. And I know some people like Burna Boy have been quite vocal, like, you know, Africans are not docile, but like they haven't hit the streets. They haven't done this, they haven't done that. And now we see that, like, it is happening. But then at the same time, I'm a bit hopeless because that's also happened like in the 60s or whatnot. Like, so I don't know if it'll be different this time around.
But don't you think that what we're seeing at the moment is an Arab Spring? Don't you think it's like equivalent to an Arab Spring?
I think so. If the momentum continues, like NSARS, and then we had Cameroon, like people are talking about Cameroon right now, they're talking about Zimbabwe, they're talking about Namibia, and then now suddenly Tanzanians have also started their own. So if it kind of, if that ripple effect is there and it goes throughout the different countries and everyone else is more vocal, is trying to tap into like diaspora voices as well, things are starting to hit CNN, blah, blah, blah. If that momentum continues, then it will be like our own spring. But again, with the Arab Spring, it lasted a long time, didn't it? And with this, not to sound pessimistic, but I do see it dying down already a little bit. And I know that's kind of privileged for me to say, sitting in the, you know, my safe house and be like, oh yes, the protests are starting to die down. People aren't going out as much as they were. but we do kind of see that happening a little bit.
Yeah, 100%, definitely. I think, well, going on from that directly, kind of a spin on what we were asking, but it's more, what's the most effective way for us to kind of support, you know, the African movements going on like currently?
Dragging leaders from their house. I'm sorry. I've seen some of the things that the French people did, what people are doing in London, like going up to like all these ambassadors and governors' houses and like rattling them. I'm sorry, but I think these kind of things are effective. Like, people are angry, people are discontent, and those that feel like they're safe because they can just travel off to like Switzerland or London or wherever, we need to actually make it known here that we're not standing for this either. Like, that kind of solidarity and comradeship, and them making noise there, we're making noise here, it's necessary.
Cool. So we've got a few more people joining us. Feel free to jump in with, you know, any comments we have.
Okay, this is the key thing to me. Bethena, do I understand you to mean that this is not an Arab Spring unless there's something to show for it? Because we know that in Tunisia and in Egypt that we had regime change. Are you saying that kind of regime change, otherwise it doesn't qualify as an Arab Spring?
Yeah, because we're seeing, like, people are talking about reform, but we're not seeing any reform. People are talking about dismantling and, you know, questioning the norm, but we're not seeing any of these. Like, African leaders are trying to actually carry on as if nothing is happening.
Kevin, do you want to say something? You want to jump in? Were you going to say something?
Maybe you're on mute. You're on mute.
Oh, anyway, no worries. Cool. So I'm trying to get back into, is there anything else you wanted to add on to that? Might I bring it back to...
No, just like, we need to solidify the change. Like, people dying can't be in vain. There needs to be something different.
There's definitely a wider conversation to have around that, almost separate from, well, not necessarily separate, but almost independent of this, because it's kind of the other way around. The question that we're asking is the effects, well, how Africa can, quote unquote, support the movement, the BLM movement. But yeah, there definitely needs to be support both ways. How does the self-identification of African-Americans affect, you know, the responsibility of Africa? Or which nation do we even expect to support the BLM movement? That make any sense?
So can you explain?
Your audio isn't
that what you said a bit more.
What was that, sorry?
Is it not working?
Can you not hear me? It's getting better. What was your question?
Oh, okay. I just wanted you to just explain what you just said just a bit more.
So my question is, how does the identification or self-identification of African-Americans, i.e. as African-Americans, not necessarily as, you know, Africans per se, not someone that says, you know, they're Nigerian-American, for example, how does that affect the responsibility of Africa in regards to supporting? So you might have someone who doesn't necessarily say they're from Nigeria or Ghana or wherever. Who would be able to kind of step in, and what responsibility do they necessarily have? Does that make sense? I think
on an individual level, we all have a role to play, and I think we're all responsible for, I kind of see things as we're all responsible for one another. Like, if they're not coming for us now, they will come for us one day. So regardless of how you identify yourself as, there is a role to play just in terms of international solidarity. Do you know what I mean? What they're doing to your brother, you should feel that personally. But then on a grander scheme of things as well, like on a more global and international level, like, for example, here in England, I don't know how to say this without sounding weird, but like, basically with the whole Corbyn gate thing, like, a lot of Jewish people were very vocal. They were like, if this happens, I will leave and I will go to Israel. With Africans, no matter how anti-Black this government is, or in America, no matter how anti-Black they are, can we really all of us together collectively say, okay, we're going to get up and we're going to leave. Where will we leave to? Where will we go? Do you know what I mean? Like, so we don't have that option to collectively all go to the motherland, because the motherland is as hectic as here. Do you know what I mean? They're shooting us here, they're shooting us there. So I think we all are responsible for how we're treated over there, if that makes sense. I do feel like we should be.
That's why a lot of
maybe turn off video and the audio will sound stronger.
Does it sound better?
I think it's about the same. Go for it. Let me try. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I agree 100%. I think there definitely needs to be some sort of solidarity across the board, regardless of how they identify. The thing that unifies us would primarily be either the origin or the colour of the skin, really, because that's what we're discriminated against. And that's one thing that we share. 100%, I definitely agree. We've discussed Ensar's protest, we discussed the issue of Congo and all of the things and stuff like that. Is Africa in a position to take a stand against the institutions of the West? And if they were, what would it look like?
How can you stand against the person feeding you? Like, no offense. Because even McFully is crazy and I don't agree with what he does. And I even said it in the last Afrolog. He's crazy. Like, and do you know what annoys me? Yeah, our leaders, and I think I was talking to Kevin about this earlier, our leaders are given the craziest nicknames. Like, McFully is known as the bulldozer. There's another leader that's known as the crocodile. I mean, these are our leaders. Like, anyways, like, all the craziness that McFully does, at the end of the day, the World Bank or whoever, anyone that's handed him a loan can turn around and be like, I don't like how you're doing this. I don't like this. Da, 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 da. So, yeah, like, how do you take a stand against institutions that have helped you in terms of infrastructure, like the money for projects, that kind of thing? So I think...
I may interrupt.
Yeah.
If I may come in. I feel like it's all about knowing the value of your resources. We did not know the value of our resources. So petroleum,
do we not?
Oil for the US. We don't. We really don't, because if we need the value of our resources, for example, petroleum and petroleum in Nigeria would have invested a lot more in ensuring refineries in Nigeria will stay open and not collapse. How many refineries are in existence in Nigeria? But a vast majority of the world's oil comes from Nigeria. So what we do is that they end up taking it from Nigeria, refining in another country, then sending it back to us refined. If we need the value of our resources and we're able to negotiate it very well, then yeah, that's how you can take back power. If I know my work. Go on.
I feel like there's a difference between knowing the worth of something and laziness and greed, because like there's so many resources in Congo, in Tanzania, like some of our leaders and our economists and whatnot have been to UCL, they've been to LSE, they're some of the brightest minds in the world. They know how much these things are worth. Not negotiating good contracts, not negotiating just the laziness and the greed and the corruption, because we know how much all of this is worth, man. It's just, I don't know. Sorry, I don't agree with that whole we don't know what it's worth. I don't know.
Perception though, because I might know what it's worth and I get where you're coming from. However,
yeah.
Even though I know what it's worth, if I'm in this position of authority for my own selfish gains, because we always see going into government as, oh yeah, to look out for the people, but the reality is and it, you see a lot more in African nations than you do in the UK, although it's more subtle in the UK, is the whole thing of I'm going to protect my interests first and my class first than anyone else's interest or other classes. So what that now looks like is if you're not wealthy, like for example in the UK, to go off on a tangent for a bit. So for example, in the UK, if you're not white, if you're not earning a certain amount of money, then things like tax cuts, tax benefits and all that won't, it's not something that if I'm in power would appeal to me. However, we see people that enter government, or we see the whole idea of being a person, a government minister, a politician as altruistic, when reality is 95% of them are selfish. So it does tie to what you're saying. However, you also got to flip it in the other angle of, if peradventure this 95% were not as self-centered as they are, you can take back power by actually standing by the wealth, aka, all right, you want our resources, that's fine, but you need to do due diligence to our country. So it still comes down, because I get where you're coming from, so it's not to say you're wrong, but it's perception, altering how we perceive the role of a person in government. Because we've always been taught from a young age, oh yeah, you know, if you want to change the world and the next generation, be a prime minister. But then you see a lot of these prime ministers and all these politicians, and you're just like, what have they done? Or they're just protecting their type, their class, their people. So yeah.
I think there are degrees to selfishness.
Yeah, I agree with you. Apart from, I was just going to quickly say, I don't think that the corruption is subtle in England, like that whole track and trace, like all these consultants married to MPs. I don't think it's subtle, but I get what you're saying. Like here, like not a lot of us are, like we're working class, but we're not like Oliver Twist, please may I have some more. So that corruption, it's not, we don't get as angry as when we see in Africa, like politicians hoarding food, hoarding noodles for crying out loud, these kind of things. So I hear what you're saying, and it is true. Like it, I don't know. This is starting to feel like a very hopeless conversation. But sorry, go on, Kevin.
You're saying that, you're saying that it's not subtle, but if we compare it to a snake eating X amount of millions, I mean, it's subtle in comparison to that. I don't know. Like, if you're saying that a snake has, monkey's taken money away, a snake has swallowed money, that's very, very clear. Someone who's a family member, you have to do a bit of research. If I hear a snake has eaten X amount of millions, I just have to hear it and know that something's dodgy. If I hear a company is, I'll have to go and find out who runs a company to then identify whether something fishy is going on.
Okay, maybe I feel that. Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Does anyone else want to jump in before I move on to the next point?
Yeah, I don't feel like it's a hopeless conversation. I think knowing the value.
No, sorry, I didn't mean hopeless. I meant like it's sad and depressing. Sorry.
Right. Yeah.
Cool.
I think Kevin was going to say something, or I don't know. Sorry, I
interrupted. I was just going to say, I think the difference between back home and here, like, there are degrees in selfishness. Somebody once had an analogy that, like, in the West and in other countries, you have a lot of corruption. You have corruption in China. You have corruption in Russia. Putin rules Russia with his oligarchs. But the thing with them is that if they steal 30%, they will use that 70% to build their nation. African leaders don't think like that. You can be a politician and you can be rich and you can still help your people. That's what the Chinese do. There's a lot of corruption in the Chinese Communist Party, in Putin's Russia. But African politicians, they, instead of maybe taking 20%, which they shouldn't be taking, but if they were going to do it, instead of taking 20% and using 80% to develop the nation, they'll take 99%, and then the rest of the people will have to fight for the scraps. So I think that, just like you were saying, it was subtle or it wasn't subtle, I think it goes down to the degree of selfishness within Western countries and Eastern countries and African countries. African leaders are just very, very selfish people.
Is that it? Would we definitely
hold on? Can I go around the room here? Oh, sorry. Going from what is it? A row?
African leaders that are being selfish, or is it there's in regards to like penalization or how they're held accountable? Is it worse back home in comparison?
Yeah. Hi, can everyone hear me?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. Yeah, so I was going to say, I don't think it's a case of a degree of selfishness. Human beings are naturally selfish. The issue is checks and balances. The issue is, are the systems Are there systems in place that allow you to be, to act on your worst human instinct, or are there systems in place that allow you to behave yourselves properly? For example, when we had the whole expenses scandals here in UK, people were outraged because MPs were taking £1 to buy Mars bars. In Nigeria, they're there taking billions and people are blinking their eyes. So it's not, I don't think it's a case of the politicians are more selfish. It's just that the system allows them to act on their worst human instincts.
But here's the thing, here's the thing. Well, here, they obey the system. They obey the checks and balances. In a lot of African countries, there were checks and balances before. But you know what happens? The president or whoever's at the top just bypasses them, just gets rid of them. Like in Nigeria, there's countless times where the president has just bypassed what the court has said or what is in the constitution. Who can bring him accountable? Nobody. Because even if you put checks and balances there, if you're corrupt, you're corrupt. Because nobody will do anything. Because when the leaders get into office, what they do, they put their guys in the military. Once you control the military in African countries, no checks and balances can do nothing to you. Because what's the judge going to do? Oh, you're not meant to do that.
I understand what you're saying, but the reason why I would like to steer clear of saying that it's just us that are selfish, because we need to understand that our leaders are Nigerian. They're just as Nigerian, they're just as African as the rest of us. The leaders we have us have came from. So if we are going to say our leaders are selfish, our leaders are this, our leaders is that, then we also need to be willing to say that the whole black race, the whole of Africa is just as selfish. And are we willing to move in that direction?
It's a dangerous precedent to set,
because the issue is what makes our leaders different from the rest of us?
I think you talked about checks and balances, but like there needs to be something intrinsically within you to not bypass those checks and balances. A lot of leaders here can also look at Donald Trump. Look what he's doing. He's manipulating the American system, the land of so-called democracy, to remove his checks and balances. He's putting people in the Supreme Court that are for his cause. He's putting people in the CIA and FBI that are for his cause. A lot of times, it does come down to your intrinsic value as well. Because a lot of American presidents have been in his shoes, have his same amount of power, but not bypass the checks and balances that is in that institution. In Africa, like I said, a lot of these checks and balances, the court, the Congress, we have that in Nigeria, we have the parliament or the Congress, we have the courts, but they bypass it. So there's also something that within yourself that you should be able to say that, look, I'm the president of the country, but I need to obey the law. I'm not above the law. And I feel like just a lot of African politicians, I'm not going to say it's inherent. I don't think it's inherent, but I think a lot of them have that mindset. Whether that is a symptom rather than a cause, that's a different conversation, but it is an issue. And I think that needs to be addressed.
I definitely think there's like a culture of almost culture of greed within that, you know, group, that makes sense. Or people who tend to aspire when they get to a certain point, as they call, what's this guy that, you know, what they say is like, what, Godfather or whatever. There's certain things that you cannot do. People who have power will not allow you to do until you kind of bend to their will. And once you've bent once, you're not then easier bent for other things. That makes sense.
I'm saying this in regards to African politicians.
Okay, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, go on.
What makes an African politician different from the average African man selling buns and akara on the streets?
Oh, can I?
The only difference is that they've been elected to power.
Can I actually jump in here for a moment? It's more than election into power. There is a game. There's a dirty political game being played in Nigeria, and what that looks like is, say, for example, somebody like Tinubu taking a young person that is quote unquote ambitious, but he can mold, manipulate, and indoctrinate so that when he now puts that person, so what they tend to do is that you have somebody like Tinubu that will take somebody, a young person from the streets, uneducated, he'll give them education. He'll give them all the things that they need, then progress them up. Then afterwards, once that person has been securely placed in power by somebody like Tinubu, that person, out of loyalty, will protect Tinubu's interests, but he doesn't realize that he's protecting Tinubu's interest because he has been groomed. So what a lot of these politicians do is that they groom the younger ones, the ones that come after them. So even if they may not necessarily physically be in power, their interests are being protected. Hence why those that have godfathers, quote unquote, they go further than those that have just been, quote unquote, elected in power. In Nigerian politics, you can't just wake up and say, oh yeah, I want to enter politics. You can't just wake up and necessarily, I mean, you can try, but the reality is it's very hard. It's ridiculously hard. And a lot of us on very, we're not aware as to how dirty, now I can't speak for other Nigerian, other African countries, because I'm not too well knowledgeable, informed about them. But what the country that I can speak on, because politics slash law is my area of interest, is Nigeria. There is a nasty political game being played, and it's done subtly, and it's done through grooming. Even though a lot of people use grooming in terms of, like, you know, sexual abuse and so forth, but no, it happens in politics.
I don't disagree with that point that you have just said. I 100% agree with it. But what I'm trying to say is, for us to say that our it's not just a case of it's just our politicians are selfish, okay? Because realistically, if we get rid of all the politicians we have now and institute new people in place, the new people are likely to behave in the exact same way. Why is that?
How
can we say differently? For example, we've had civil wars, we've had revolutions, we've had change of government in our country. So I just want us to clarify who we're placing the blame on. To say that it's politicians, as if they're a breed of people who aren't African, I find it odd.
So if you go back through the process that I said, which is basically you take somebody like Tinubu, who has the ideas. So even if he is no longer in power, his ideologies, his interests are still there, irrespective of who is still present. The perfect person to look at is somebody like Obasanjo. When was the last time that he was actively a president? But if he still has power like never before. So the issue is not the physical representation. The issue, this is the thing, we keep looking at the physical representations. We keep looking at physical beings. You got to understand that it's the ideologies that have been passed down from generations to generations that have changed face.
I think me and you are saying the same thing, but we're saying it in different ways. Like you say, Tinubu is not the issue, with the example you gave. But what I'm trying to say is that if we put another person in place, another person will groom children or groom younger people the same way. I'm not focused on the person, because the point of my argument is that we can't just say our politicians are selfish as if they're a breed of people. If we put other people in the same place, if we put other Nigerians or other Africans in their positions, other Nigerians will most likely do the same thing.
Let me just clarify
if that's the role we're going down or not.
Let me jump in there. Bring it back to the level. So obviously we're discussing how you know, Africa can support the BLM movement. Yeah. So we've explored a few of the things that, you know, are issues within, you know, our countries that are preventing that. What would it look like? What does Africa support look like? But before that, what do we need to do in our countries to establish a level in which we are then able to support movements that are going on in diaspora, such as...
Sorry, Rashid, can I just address a point that was made a minute ago?
Continue into this
one. Right, I'm continuing. Yeah. So I think... I don't know who's making the point, but I think the issue is that when we're talking about obviously changing what's going on in African countries, we're talking about also changing the cycle of people like Tinubu, of bad leadership. So I think actually, Amara, to answer your question, I think the difference between the average citizen and the political leaders who are doing bad things is that there's now become a political class, a culture of people who don't really participate in society in the same way because of money, who behave a certain way, and it continues. And I think in normal cases, what we would do to hold them account would be for them to have an internal moral code that allowed them to behave the right way. But now I think we need to be more aggressive in how we hold them to account. So I think we need to be using more aggressive means in Africa and the diaspora, Rashid, to answer your question, to hold people to account. It needs to be really aggressive and it needs to be in your face. And I think that's what Bethena was alluding to.
Bethena, you want to double up on that?
I just wanted to say, because this kind of... Oh, sorry.
Go on.
Sorry. I think this kind of conversation stemmed from when we compared British MPs to African MPs. And it's just the fact that we need to remember in England, this government had hundreds of years to solidify the rule. Whereas someone mentioned, you know, in African countries, you'll have a great leader, there'll be foreign interventions, they'll get him out, there'll be a coup, there'll be a this, there'll be a that. So even if we do replace a leader with someone, you know, we had Sankara, we had whoever, do you know what I mean? Because we haven't established that rule of law, because we haven't established those checks and balances that Kevin mentioned earlier, like, you can't hold, it's not that we're, and I really agree with, I don't know if it's Edmund or whatever, that we're inherently greedy or we're inherently corrupted as Africans, because we're not. It's just the fact that we've not had those hundreds of years without foreign intervention to establish those laws, to cement those laws, so that when a greedy person comes into power, we have those tools to either get him out or, you know, I don't know, like, you, those checks and balances, basically. That's what I wanted to mention.
I agree with what you said, but I don't like some Nigerians and some Africans always like bring in this length of time, like, oh, these people had 100 years to develop. We've only been independent for blah blah blah.
It's not just independent though. I'm talking about even since we gained independence, those foreign powers playing political tools. If they don't like someone, they will replace him. It's that kind of, we've not had that just a hundred years just to just.
Honest question. I'll bring this back to the BLM movement, but why were countries like China and South Korea and Taiwan and Singapore and the United Arab Emirates and Botswana, why were they all able to develop in a short space of time?
Well, if you're talking about Arabia is using blooming
slave labor from
Africans and Asians to build. Yeah, so unless we go down the slave labor route.
No, I'm talking about, but there's also Singapore, there's Taiwan, there's South Korea. Anyway, but they developed in a very short space of time. So I don't think we need 100 years. I actually think if we do have a great leader, we can do it fast. But to go back to what was previously said about BLM, it's very hard for people on the continent, I think, to give vocal support to the BLM movement, because a lot of people on the continent don't have access to internet, one, and the ones that do, it's normally through data, don't have the money to be getting data like that. Like, we normally have a data package, we get like 20 gigs, 40 gigs for a month. It's not too expensive, it's £20 or so. Data in, I'm using my country, Nigeria, for example, is one of the highest in the world. I think it is the highest in the world. I saw a report about it. So not only is there a lack of internet connectivity to maybe connect to the rest of the world in a large amount, but it's also really expensive. The Nigerians we see on Nigerian Twitter, they tend to be from Lagos. Lagos and Abuja is the only place you have somewhat of a middle class that can, you know, be vocal to an extent. And we see that a lot of Nigerians have started trends, like, you know, the Scoopy to Mana, all of these things, from a small population from Lagos and Abuja. I think if we had more access to the internet, we would be able to support our brothers in the US, our brothers in Colombia that are getting killed for being activists, our brothers in Brazil that are getting killed by police, and even in a higher rate than America. But because we don't even have that basic infrastructure to make ourselves visible, it's very hard.
Like, it's very hard. How can people in Tanzania, in Uganda, protest about Black Lives Matter if they can't get on the internet? So I think that's...
Okay, Kevin, sorry. Just to answer the reverse question, because we did want to talk about the other protests happening in Africa as well. Do you feel like there's been a lack of support for what's going on in Africa, in the West, in Western countries?
From the BLM itself, actually. Do you think there's been a lack of support within the BLM movement for end SARS? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Not just for
SARS, but also for the Shut It Down movements and for the Zimbabwe Lives Matter and so on.
Okay, I'm going to give this opinion. I don't know how you guys are going to take it. For a lot of the interactions I see between continental Africans and African Americans, it's not nice. A lot of ignorance, it goes both ways, but I've seen a lot of continental Africans say some disgusting things to Black Americans. I've seen a lot of continental Africans laugh about police brutality. They've called Black Americans hashtags. It's got loads of retweets. They've laughed about Black Americans getting killed. They've laughed about slavery. This isn't an incident where I just saw two people in a conversation. I've seen, it's mostly Nigerians. Let me not say continental Africans, but it's mostly, I'm Nigerian myself as well, but it's mostly Nigerians. They almost every other like week, you have continental African, mostly of Nigerian descent, antagonizing Black Americans, saying, oh, how come Black Americans don't know where they're from? Oh, these Black Americans are so ignorant. They don't even know where they're from. Oh, they've said a lot of disgusting things. If I was Black American, I'm seeing how continental Africans, it might be a loud minority, but if I'm seeing you guys laugh at people getting killed, calling AA's hashtags, laughing at slavery, I'm not really gonna be too bothered to be, you know, shouting up and down about your movements. There's a friction there between continental Africans and African Americans, and being unbiased, a lot of times the ignorance does come from Nigerians. So I think that's why there hasn't been widespread support from African Americans. There's been quite a lot, but not maybe to the extent you might be thinking of.
Can I come in there really quickly?
Yeah.
So this whole thing of like we supported this person or like the diaspora supporting Africa back home, I find it to be very, very odd. And going back to the initial question of Africans on the continent supporting Black Lives Matter movement, I actually find it quite insulting to expect Africans back home to support the Black Lives Matter movement. Not saying that they shouldn't support it, but like Kevin said before, some of these people don't have access to internet. Some of these people are struggling to send their children to school. Some people don't know where they're going to get their next meal from. They are facing life or death situations in their face every single day, and we want them to support something going on abroad. To me, that doesn't make sense. That's number one. And number two, I think the whole idea again of when it's like of Africans or Nigerians insulting African Americans or what's it called, Black people in the diaspora, I don't think that statement is also fair on the converse as well, because we get the same, Africans on the continent get the same insults from Africans in America. We've all been called African booty scratchers. We've all had people telling us that we live in huts, that we're not civilized, this, that, and the other. And this has come from Black people. So
the are you in America?
We don't like ourselves. I'm not in America, but I have cousins in America. Even in the UK here, it happens.
I was about to say that, yeah.
It goes both ways. We don't like ourselves.
I did point that the ignorance goes both ways. All I said is that from what I've seen from online interactions, a lot of times us Nigerians, just speaking as a Nigerian, we tend to think it's just one way, that it's just African Americans calling Africans booty scratchers. The ignorance goes both ways. And I feel like it would really help if both people can say that, yo, like, both people are in the wrong. But I feel like when Black people are talking amongst ourselves, it's very tribalistic. It's we're right, you're wrong. We're right, you're wrong. I wish more people could be like, yo, yeah, African-Americans are wrong at calling Black people booty scratchers and saying we live in huts. But Black people at home in Africa are wrong for calling them hashtags and making fun of slavery. I just wish we could have that balanced conversation.
Okay, bring it back. How?
I 100% agree with you on that point. So we should have a balanced conversation. But again, going back to us supporting them supporting us.
Is it Edmund that's talking? What's your name?
Well, my name's Amara, but I'm using my friend's Zoom.
Let's bring it back to me. How effective do we feel like the support would be if African content was to support the BLM movement in comparison?
I don't think it will be effective in whatever way possible. Look, a lot of the people in our government doesn't care about us. So nothing we're gonna, like, how do we want it to be effective? How will it possibly be effective? Our own government doesn't listen to us. It's not the American government that's going to now listen to us.
That is true. African governments don't care about Black lives. So it's funny to think they're going to care. They don't care about Black lives in Africa. So there's no way they're going to care about... In fact, one Nigerian senator said that he loved how Americans dealt with the Black Lives Matter movement, because he was like, they should have stopped complaining or blah blah. This is a Nigerian politician. So this is how they reason. At modern stage, Africa is very irrelevant in the world geopolitics. It doesn't have any economic power, it doesn't have any military power, it doesn't have any clout except being a place where they steal resources. So I think it's very hard for Africa to really make an impact at this stage. It might change in the future.
Cool. Regards, I think it was someone mentioned earlier on in regards to the everyday person living in Africa. It's apparently they don't have much, basically, they're struggling to send children to school. And obviously we understand that it's not everyone that's in that situation. So I'm guessing that those that are not in those positions who have left. I guess, completely where they could support the cause. How does the relatability of Africans living in Africa have an effect on level of support that can be offered by the nations? So if people who live in Africa, they don't necessarily relate, quote unquote, to people who are living in the diaspora, or if there's issues going on in a particular country, would the people in the country be comfortable with the nation supporting something outside of the country? Does that make sense?
Could you explain that again, please?
Yeah.
In SARS is happening in Nigeria, for example, and the Nigerian government says, no, let's go support what's happening in London instead. In my opinion, I don't think that would go down well.
They should face the affronts. it genuinely doesn't make sense for your responsibility as a government is first and foremost to the people that elected you. Your responsibility as a government is first and foremost to your own people. You can't be using your resources and spending time to support Black Lives Matter in America, but you can't treat your own people. I find it shocking. Like, it doesn't even make sense to me. Why would we even expect people in Africa to support whatever's going on in the diaspora? We see people in Lagos, that some people in the continent may have means to find out what's going on, but let's not be fooled. That is a small minority of the country, a ridiculously small minority of the country. Like, it doesn't, it's not even country, the continent. So what are,
I was just going to say, in an ideal world, like, I'm all for international solidarity and everyone should be fighting for all the causes out there. But at the same time, like, if you look at Tanzania, because of the murderings that have been happening since the election, they blocked off the internet. Tanzanians can't even tweet about what's going on in Tanzania. So, you know, I kind of agree. If we can't even get this trending, how would we be of support to people abroad? Like, there's other countries, as I said before, like, other countries, like, if something goes on in, like, the Israel government can do big things. Like, I think Gucci or something, they
they did something that was contentious or I don't know, and then Chinese, like China, all these Asian countries, they can put their foot down and they can make like the international realm, the international sphere listen to the issue. But we can't do that. We can't even do it for our own issues, let alone.
Well, you know, the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, did speak out on Black Lives. This is back in September. And he said, he quoted Martin Luther King and he said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So on a philosophical level, Kevin, I don't know how you feel about that. Like, do you feel like the president shouldn't have said anything? Or do you think that, I mean, at least if he mentioned something, it's better than not?
All they can do is mention things. After they finish mentioning things and they go back to normal, what was the point of mentioning the thing?
Well, that's the thing.
Like, we can't do anything is the truth of the matter. And to expect us to do anything, again, I find it, they weren't elected by the American citizens. No one in America elected them.
So
let them deal with the electorate first.
So, Africans in the diaspora, or Black people in the diaspora, there's no one country, there's no one place that kind of can support or fight that battle as a, we've been considered a minority, quote unquote, in the West. So if we're saying that Africa is that place that's supposed to kind of support or fight our battles or, you know, fight for our liberties, what do we need to do? What needs to happen in our nation first before we can get to a point where we can start discussing what the nation can do to protect its skin folk, if that makes sense?
There needs to be an African
law. One by one.
Okay.
I didn't hear anything.
Sorry, Bethena, you can go.
No, it's okay, go.
So what I was going to say is the only points we will get to a point where Africa can protect the interest of Africans in the diaspora when there's an African superpower. We don't even need a superpower. When an African country holds weight on the international scale. Right now, they don't need to listen to us. So there's nothing we're going to say that's going to make them move.
Makes sense. And how do you go
from time it's still being looked at as a country and not a continent. That's how you know. Like, we are not respected in the international realm. Our leaders aren't respected. From time people are playing games with our elections, like foreign companies, foreign governments are playing games with our elections. That's what you know. We can't even hold a fair election, let alone. So I think rule of law needs to be established first.
Didn't Ara London say something earlier about what Amara just mentioned about international power and geopolitics and economic empowerment as well? I think that's definitely come up a few times. And maybe Chinese influence. Does anyone think the Chinese influence might make a difference as well?
Chinese influence on what?
Well, Chinese influence in Africa.
Their presence, or?
Well, for example, if the Chinese, I mean, this came up in the discussion we had last week about China and Africa, and the theory is that the more investment financially that Chinese companies and the government has in Africa, the more it's going to fight for African interests on the global stage. So does anyone think that that's going to be effective, having China as a big brother in terms of international weight?
Can I jump in here? I don't think China can.
If it was a more big, equal.
I don't think China can ever be a big brother. Big bully, yes. They designed their debt, their loans, or their quote unquote support in such a way that it's done to oppress you. So I can't remember what African country it is, but essentially they could not pay back the loan that they had received under quote unquote friendly terms. And so what they did was that they went in and took control of a vast majority of the manufacturing. We have to be quite mindful as to who we receive support from, because a lot of these superpowers, quote unquote, they design it in such a way that it is a Trojan horse. Another thing that I've noticed as well, because China, their influence is becoming more and more known in Nigeria. So I was speaking with my younger cousin, and apparently now they've made it mandatory in some high schools in Nigeria to learn Mandarin. Now, that might not be a big deal because we're just like, oh, okay, that's a pretty cool language to learn. But if you go back through colonialism, one thing that was evident of a country being under someone else's power was a change of language. So this whole need for them to learn Mandarin, then I think it's English, then Mandarin, or something along those lines. We just have to be careful because a lot of these countries, they use their quote unquote, their support as a Trojan horse. We'll support you. You can be our, we'll be like a big brother to you. But in reality, they're still stealing from, they're still taking advantage from, and they're still being a bully.
At the end of the day.
So, yeah.
China are there for the Chinese people. They're going to look after their own. We need to get to a position where we can look after them. So it's not, I don't think we need to get to a point where we're leaning on anyone to get that power. I know what I'm saying might sound airy fairy, but I'm not sure how we go about doing it. But we need to establish that power ourselves.
I feel like in the international realm, it doesn't help to hurt friends, because like that was one of the main reasons why China went into Africa anyway. It was just like, you know, that one China policy, having people to support them at the international table. So if it was a more fair and equal relationship, then this would be cool. But as we know, like Amara mentioned that, sorry, is it Aral? Their loans, their conditions, there's a non-interference element of it. So although they're giving us the money, there's no support, there's no intervention. So even when things go down, like, I don't think we should be thinking that they'll be there to back it, if that makes sense.
But I understand Dami's point in regards to protecting their investment 100%. I don't know how we'll go about doing that, to be honest. Okay.
Geopolitics, international relations.
Cool. Any more points on that? Cool. So I'm guessing from our conversation, it sounds like we're saying that currently Africa doesn't have much of a, I guess, much influence on what happens in the world for it to have a positive or even any effect on what happens in regards to protests in the UK, in the diaspora generally. And that the protests that happen in Africa need to be well supported by those of diaspora to kind of put pressure on and to make sure that the leaders in Africa don't take the diaspora as a safe haven, a way to kind of run away from the issues back home, making it back to what Nathan said about dragging them up. Yeah?
Yeah.
There's nothing else anyone else wants to contribute to that? Then it's been a really intriguing conversation, a really intriguing discussion. Thank you all for contributing. And you
know, sorry, can I ask one more question? Is that okay? I want to ask how people feel about violent upheaval and doing Jerry Rawlings. This came up a couple of weeks ago, but in terms of protest movements.
I think peaceful protests, I don't think there's any situation where peaceful protests actually ever change anything. Everything that...
Woo!
No, but no, can you give me an example?
Kevin, I'm with you on this one. Please, continue. Yeah.
Can you give me... Look, let me give you some examples. I grew up in Ireland. Irish people were basically colonized by the British for 800 years until, guess what? They fought the British. They were given independence. French Revolution, that basically changed the whole thing for France. The USA became a country through violent revolution. Like, there's no instance in history, I don't think of, where anything has been done by peaceful protest. Any significant change has been made. Peaceful protest is a tool in the changing process. Peaceful protest is there to highlight things. It's there to bring awareness to things. But I don't think peaceful protest changes anything. It only just brings awareness. I think things change through either civil disobedience or through violent means. You see, in America, this Black Lives Matter thing has been happening since before Trump. It happened over with Obama, but it used to be relatively quite peaceful until they started burning stuff up, until it started affecting their capital, until, you know, they started looting stuff. Now it's hurting them economically. So I think things only change through revolution, through either violent means or civil disobedience.
Can I come in? So I hear you 100% on that. However, here's the thing. When you change your protest from peaceful to violent, you have to be prepared for war. And the reality is that a lot of... let's look at NSARS and be practical with NSARS. If NSARS was to completely turn violent and the Nigerian government switches on us, quote unquote, reality is do we have the resources for war? Can we stand ground? And as much as I'm for NSARS, but let's not overstretch ourselves. Let's not overestimate our resources. If all the Nigerian government needs to do is lock up the internet, and it's done, it's a shutdown. We'll have no idea what's going on in Nigeria or anything like that. So with the examples that you gave, it worked because they were prepared for war. The question, even with the whole Black Lives Matter, in the states that it went really violent and they started bringing out the military trucks, understand that they started mellowing down. The impact did not go all around the economy. It only affected a little bit of the economy in that particular state or in that particular town. It did not carry throughout the 50-something states in America. So the question is that if you're going to switch from peaceful to violent, are you ready for war? Realistically, are you ready to lose everything? And that's a question. And like longevity-wise as well, can we sustain it? Because if we enter a headlock with the Nigerian government, how long are we going to keep it going for? So I hear you about, changes, a lot of the major changes that we celebrate, you know, happen through war, but let's also be real. They planned it. They were ready to lose it all. The saying that goes that if you fight with somebody, it has nothing to lose. Be prepared to lose everything. Are we ready for that?
And I think, I totally agree. I think eventually, I hope it doesn't reach that point, but if African countries don't develop and keep regressing, I think it's going to reach the point where people are not going to be scared to die, and they're going to be ready for war. I don't think it's reached that point yet, because do you think it's reached that point?
Hi, Kevin.
I think it has. I think it's slowly getting there. For the fact that definitely, let's call a spade, because for the fact that we have international ears, even though we might not necessarily think that they're as effective, or we might wonder, okay, but now we have international ears, but you guys are responsible for a lot of our problems, so forth and so forth. The reality is we have their ears. You now have people like SARS, Fowles speaking on international platforms. You now have his father, Mr. Falana, now involved. You have it's reaching that point. And also, you got to remember that the Nigerian government don't see us as citizens. They see us as children. So there's a huge aspect of culture that comes in as well. So they don't see us. And you got to also go through, you have to know the enemy you're fighting with. So you have to go all the way back to Buhari's first ever term in 1983 and be able to actually understand that this guy does not stand for indiscipline. So if you go back to his first ever term that he got into power based on, he did a coup, and so he took power. So when the military coup happened and he was able to run Nigeria for about 2 years before someone else came over and he was imprisoned, he did a war on indiscipline. And what that looked like, it was that even the slightest complaint against the government, whether you're media, whether you're a musician, Fela was arrested under his rule. Fowles' father was arrested under that rule. So you also need to know who you're up against. Now let's look at the fact, the dirty play that they did on the last 2 weeks. That was horrible. That violated a lot of the articles under the Rome articles of the ICC. But yet you're dealing with somebody that does not care. So the reality is it has gone that far. For them to do a less than 4 hours lockdown, understand that this is a subtle war. And if we keep pushing, and I'm all for keeping pushing, like for us to keep going, but we now need to strategize and no longer think that, this is just another protest and we can protest how we do it in the West. No, it's war. They're now seeing us as disobedient children. They're now seeing us, like I said, the Nigerian government don't see us as civilians. They see us as children. My parents weren't that, well, my dad was traditional, my mom isn't. So if you ever lock heads with my dad, in that moment, you're a child. You're supposed to be seen, not heard, and that's how they see the citizens. We only need you, we want your votes, but we don't need you to talk, we don't need, we don't even remember, we don't need to be questioned, exactly,
just do as we say kind of thing.
It's really hard because we don't want to see people, like, we know revolution, especially violent revolution, it's probably gonna be the fastest way to get the change we need. It's probably gonna be what is needed, but it's also hard because we're sitting on the privilege of being abroad. You know, if anything goes down, it's not us that is affected. So in one mind where you want it to happen, in another mind you're just like, you don't want to see people hurt. So it's very hard. You don't want to see the people who are already suffering there now be suffering a war, but in another mind you're thinking, okay, a violent revolution would be a way to change everything. So I'm gonna say
something a bit clinically emotionally detached, in the sense that for every good thing that we're benefited from in our respective countries, right, so even as Nigerians, lives were lost. So for the freedom that can now be enjoyed by us, by generations after those that fought in that battle, lives were lost. I think it's humanitarian law that says that if the outcome is greater than the lives that were lost, then it can be justified. And that's what I'm saying about the realities of war. I hear you, in an ideal world, you know, we should be able to protest, our voices heard. But for every war that you see, that, you know, like I said, the benefits, when we're enjoying it, we take for granted, or we don't even remember how much lives were lost for us to have the freedom. It might not be 100% freedom, but for us to have the freedom that we now have today, we take a lot for granted. And so I hear you. But is it feasible? I don't really think so.
Yeah.
I don't think it's currently feasible, but I think we need to get to a stage where it's feasible, because the people that we're dealing with, like you said, they don't see us as citizens. We can peacefully protest from here to China. We will peacefully protest. We are up against people that, you said, they see us as children. I think children is even giving us too much respect. They see us as goats.
Yeah, I think they see Nigerian people as animals.
So the thing is, we need to get to a point where it does become do or die, because at this moment in time, we might not be in a war, but think of the amount of people that are dying because they don't have health care. Think of the people that are dying on the streets every day because the roads are bad. Think of the people that are dying because of armed robbery. Think of the people that are dying because the police are holding guns like they're toys. Yeah. So people are already dying. Let's be real. Yeah. People are already dying.
It's true.
It's a sad state of affairs.
It's real, and I know there are other African people on this pod that are not Nigerian. So I know sometimes we censor it on Nigeria a lot, but I think the same thing is happening all over Tanzania.
Yeah, they just rigged an election. They just rigged it.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think we should tell people who are dissatisfied, who are frustrated, who are aggravated, how they should conduct their protests. Like, all of these protests, like Shut It Down, what's happening in Tanzania, what's happening with NSARS, even BLM in America, to police people, to tell people how they should conduct themselves, I think is patronizing, is condescending. Like, as Kevin said, throughout history, people have got to the point where they've thought, this is it. Like, even with women's rights, she felt there was no other way but to jump in front of the horse. So I think to tell people how they should conduct their protest is so messed up. Like, I just don't think we should. People are angry, and if they want to loot, if they want to do that, that's because, like, they felt that there's no other choice. And also, I hate to police people and how they should protest, but I find some of the protesting, like, these celebrities standing in their gardens or leaders going down on their knee, like these kind of things are just, you're in a position of power, either through influence or actual political power. Why are you doing what the people have felt that they needed to do? That as well, I think, is messed up. Like, what are you walking in the street for? What are you marching for? What are you going down on your knee for when you're actually in a position to affect change? So I think, although we shouldn't tell the normal people how they should protest, I think we do need to talk to celebs and politicians, because I don't know what the hell they're doing.
I hear you. Some of them make the protest quite cheesy. I saw a video, somebody proposing to their partner in a police brutality protest. Like, that doesn't make sense to me. Why are you proposing?
And even the dancing.
Yeah.
I'm not here to tell people how to do their protest, but it's like you're ruining the message somehow. Like the dancing, this is serious shit. This is life or death.
Definitely redacted. But we've come to. Is there any more questions, Pathena Dami? Do you have anything else to throw in there?
No, I feel like we've covered a lot.
No worries. Now I can round off for real now. Cool. Now, thank you very much for everyone who's come today. It's been amazing having you. Very engaging conversation. I never expected it. Well, thanks. Please check us out on Instagram and Twitter at AfroLogPod.
Thank you, guys. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.